Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. The Jug Life is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like weightlifters, powerlifters, and CrossFitters get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/juglife to support the show and see if you qualify. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/juglife or mention the promo code JUGLIFE when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I am joined, as always, by mirthful Max Montana. Max, how you doing, buddy?
Good, how you doing?
Good, good. So today we are going to be answering some of your questions that you sent to us through the Instagram and Facebook. And today's episode is brought to you by Ribeyes and Dumbbell Flies. It's a lifestyle. So we got a lot of questions to answer, so let's go ahead and just get right into it. Leading off with a question from yo friend Marcus, who asks for Max, why do I keep broad jumping every time I snatch?
Watching your videos, what's happening is as the bar passes your knee, you're opening your hips too soon, pulling your shoulder behind the barbell, moving your hips forward to the bar, shifting all your body weight forward to your toe. You make contact, the bar moves horizontally, you're aggressive enough to keep moving, picking your feet up and land under it. It's a common problem for a lot of lifters that are kind of newer. It all stems from having too much effort put into the wrong place in the lift. You're trying to accelerate the bar while it's too low in the pull, and you're driving everything into the bar in a horizontal fashion. There's no extension of the leg, no contribution from the upper body and the top of the pull to make everything move vertically. Quick fix for that would be do lots of exercise without moving your feet. Snatch with no hook, no feet. Without moving your feet, you're forced to pull without jumping forward, obviously. And without a hook, you can't make as aggressive of an explosion at the top, so you'll be forced to use your upper body more. And then things like no contact, just another variation of that. But that's what I would do.
All right. Simple. Simple enough. Not easy, but simple. Yeah.
Good luck.
All right. And then we had several questions that sort of touched on this topic, which for a bit bigger discussion. People asking about the differences of building up to a top set versus doing straight across sets versus and then how drop sets or down sets figure into this equation. And these are things that I think both of us incorporate all of them in there. So to sort of address what's the benefits and maybe drawbacks potentially to some of these different things and when we use these different strategies. So straight across sets, first off, I'd say straight across sets are probably what I'm prescribing more frequently, I'd say, in hypertrophy blocks than strength or peaking blocks. And I think that I use straight across sets, so this would be all the sets at the same weight, as well as when I'm using some sort of undulation during a strength block to the low days, the low or medium days.
Yeah,
I would often prescribe straight across sets. Or even within the same vein as a straight across set, I would prescribe a weight range for the sets to be done in, and I don't really care where in that range they occur. Or let's say if it was five sets of four, maybe five sets of four at 75% to 80%. I don't really care if all five sets of four happen at 75 or all five sets of four happen at 80, or if it's up and down within that. I would consider that a straight set concept as well. I think that can fit in well in hypertrophy, and that we'll talk about why other times where we don't do that in hypertrophy, because hypertrophy is driven by increased volume. So doing straight across sets is very simple to increase volume. That this week you did four sets of eight at a given weight, and next week you do five sets of eight at the same weight. So it's just very straightforward. way to make sure you're satisfying the principle of overload. And in the case of hypertrophy, that's increasing volume. And then for the light days, light or medium days, depending on what type of undulating scheme I might be using during strength, straight across sets are good because it's you don't leave it up to the discretion of the athlete so much. So when the purpose of the day is, you know, a bit of volume, a bit of lower neural fatigue, it's not intended to be as heavy a day. That's a simple way to kind of protect the athlete from them from themselves.
Yeah.
What about straight sets and stuff for
in weightlifting? I use a lot of straight sets. Would probably almost always be applied in SPP exercises where we're doing, like, especially for fixing weaknesses, technical weaknesses. So like if you have an issue in the top of the pull, we'll do straight sets at prescribed intensities. Same as Chad, but it's always a range. For something like a block snatch or a hang snatch or whatever variation it is.
I think that the range is necessary, particularly as intermediate and advanced athlete who can take a bit more ownership of their training to let them see how they feel that day. And when I talked about, you know, not really caring if the athlete goes at the bottom end of the range, the top end of the range, or up and down, in the course of that one training session, it may seem like a big difference if they do, you know, 5x4 at 80 instead of 5x4 at 75. But when you kind of average out all the numbers at the end of the whole training cycle, you know, 12 or 16 weeks, whatever it may be, it's barely creating really any difference. Just keep in mind that the training doesn't happen in a vacuum. So if you push it all to the heavier end of things, the next session is probably going to end up being at the lower end of things.
Yeah, that's generally, I think the straight sets are generally the case, especially when I think from a technical standpoint, right? Because constantly, while there is benefit to changing the intensity someone's training at, like in waves or whatever, the straight sets, you're always going to be working with exercises that are generally difficult or challenging technically to fix weaknesses. So having more set sort of strict standards is going to allow you to train that better. That's been my experience, at least.
Yeah, so then the other part of this is the concept of building up in weight. So building to a top set and then drop sets. And these are going to be related. So really two ways we could look at building up to a top set. Let's say if we're doing we want to get to a top set of five. You could do multiple sets of five to get there. Or you could use sets of one, two, and three as you build up. And then take your one top set of five. And if you use the second option, you're probably going to be incorporating some downsets as well. If you use the first option, maybe you aren't going to be incorporating any downsets. And the option of building up, you know, let's for this example to a top set of five, building up with sets of five is, you know, not the best strategy to get to the highest set of five at the end. So during a strength block, when the goal is to push intensity, to lift a heavier weight week after week, microcycle after microcycle, building up with the same number of reps throughout for an intermediate or advanced athlete is likely going to induce too much fatigue along the way. So that's probably not a great strategy. For a beginner athlete, though, it may be appropriate because they may not be able to predict as well what weight they get to. So doing those sets along the way would be a simpler way to find the weight. You don't want to make it too small a jumps from one to the next. But and then the other thing is that the weights aren't going to be as fatiguing to the more beginner athlete. So it may not reduce the amount that they can lift on that last set by as much. You know, if I was going up to a 5 rep max in the squat, let's say maybe that would be 750 for five or something. If I did, you know, 660 for five, 680 for five, 700 for five, 720 for five, you know, the idea that I could do 750 for five after all of those would probably be unlikely. So I might need to use some smaller weights, but if you're going up to 225 for five and you did, you know, 185 for five, 205 for five, 225 for five, Maybe.
Not significant.
Yeah, it's not going to be as significant. Maybe you'd end up at 220 for five instead of 225.
By the way, if you're doing 750 for five, you're done squatting. You don't need to keep squatting. It's over. You've hit the top.
But, you know, using myself as an example in this, I actually do a lot of times do.
Yeah.
I'm saying do
you
a
do
lot.
You do a lot. Yeah. You definitely do a lot.
No, we're not the PowerCast. There's no poop jokes around here. Come on.
Edit that out, Shorty.
Professionalism. but I will do sets of five on the way up to that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't do as many, so I'd make bigger jumps.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe it would be 650 for five, 700 for five, 750 for five, and then back down to 680 for a couple extra sets to satisfy the same total volume. And earlier in the strength phases, that would be more appropriate than later in the strength phases, or if you have multiple strength mesocycles that you're going to go through.
How do you, because really what you're talking about is it's fatigue management, or, well, not so much fatigue management. It's really just a matter of how you're inducing the fatigue for that particular session. If you have an equal amount of volume working up in fives to your top set of five versus working up in singles to a top set of five, then doing down sets, there's probably a variation in the effect that fatigue is going to have on your technical execution of the lift, but also on your ability to tolerate the training and your relative or your perceived difficulty in that session, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a very, very large volume of fives planned for the day,
fives,
it might be easier to accomplish that amount of work, or psychologically easier, if they're done in drop sets than if that same work was to be done in escalating sets. Whereas early in a training cycle, if you're, or a training block, you're planning to have an overload later on, you may do things like escalating sets of five, and then the next time you do that workout, you're escalating again. Then the last time you do the same amount of volume in fives, but you do them as down sets, that top set of five you can achieve a greater overload. Does it make sense? So you start out more difficult, reduce the perceived difficulty of the training and the actual difficulty without actually changing the amount of volume. You're still able to escalate volume and intensity across each workload because of the way you actually perform the workload.
Yeah. And that strategy that Max just described is kind of the same thing that I would do. Because as you get closer to competition, the intensity and the weight on the bar is more significant. And while further away from the competition, the building up the volume is more significant. So the average may end up being higher in the earlier, the building up with the sets of five, while the absolute intensity of the top of the highest set and the you know, neural components that come in to that and psychological components would be harder in the latter weeks, where we do, you know, lower reps in the buildup than just the single high set with the down sets after it. And the psychological part of things and how the athlete perceives the training is definitely important too. So I think Max and I both prescribe this a lot. In hypertrophy would be to work up to a rep max, six, eight, 10 reps, whatever it is, with down sets after, like drop 8 to 15% and perform, you know, two sets. So let's say we're going to go up to an 8 rep max at 8 RPE, or what we might call a conservative 8 rep max, and then do two sets of 8 at 8 to 15% less than that rep max. Then the next week we'd go to a moderate 8 rep max or an 8 rep max at 9 RPE, and now do 3 drop sets. And then the final week, absolute 8 rep max or an 8 rep max at 10 RPE, and do 4 drop sets, because we're in hypertrophy. Again, we're looking to increase volume from week to week, hence the escalating number of drop sets. So, but if we were to just give the athlete, you know, 5 sets of 8 right off the bat, you know, all at the same weight across, it may, There's definitely not as much fun in doing straight sets as there is top sets. So when you're doing really that grueling, grinding work of, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, the dreaded 8 sets of 8, physically impossible, of course. it can give a bit of a psychological break to give the top set with down sets.
Yeah. One thing I've seen that, like pyramids, I don't think we do a lot of pyramids where it's up, you know, increasing in intensity, reducing in weight, sorry, reducing reps and then descending the same way. But, you know, like another variation where there's the total volume's the same, but you're doing a set of eight, a set of two, a set of seven, a set of three, you know, this kind of thing where it's, you're executing the same amount of volume. It's just how it's tolerated, right? The perceived challenge, your ability to maintain better technical execution of the lift because the perceived difficulty is less, is, you know, there's a small factor of that in play too.
Yeah. And I would say that the really the only benefit to that type of thing would be psychological.
Yes.
I never prescribed that just because you're likely going to run into a thing of like violating a phase potentiation,
right?
In that you're have too wide of
a big spread between those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, equating the volume, if the volume is equated at the end, it's not going to be that big of a difference. No. Like
the main, yeah. I mean, the main thing is always going to be in hypertrophy is the ability to do more volume, right? Your goal is to increase volume. And so any of these methods that are used is what allows you to achieve that overload best, or how are you able to incorporate more volume without, you know, for one, the practical side, people adhering to the program, and then two, executing the program to the best of their abilities. So,
yeah. So hopefully you can take that information and, apply it to your own training there. Several people who asked about that. So let's take a quick break for a Strength History Minute, and then we'll be back with some more Q&A. David Riegert is one of the most storied weightlifters of all time. Gold medalist in the 1976 Olympics, Riegert was also a 5-time world champion representing the Soviet Union. He broke 68 world records during his career, including PRs of 170 in the snatch, 212.5 in the clean and jerk in the 90-kilo class. U.S. Olympian Mike Kartschut went up against him in the 1970 World Championships, telling us that Riegert missed his first clean at 182, went to the back, came back on a second and made it. The clean was very difficult, and they missed the jerk. He came out for his third attempt, cleaned it, said he was standing there like it was going to kill him, maybe standing for 10 seconds with the bar before attempting and making the jerk. Riegert also claims training PRs of 300 kilos for 6 in the squat, 170 kilo strict press, 200 kilos snatch during training, and powers of 160 in the snatch and 200 in the clean. The Jug Life is proud to be sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like powerlifters, weightlifters, and CrossFitters get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/juglife to support the show and see if you qualify. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people, including powerlifters, weightlifters, and CrossFitters. 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 and 33% on their life insurance. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ. Health IQ can save our customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. Learn more and get a free quote at healthiq.com/juglife. That's to see if you qualify and get your free quote at healthiq.com/juglife, or mention the promo code JUGLIFE when you talk to a Health IQ agent. All right, so we are back from the Strength History Minute, getting back into some Q&A. And this question that comes from at C. Willis, and he asked about, as a golfer, incorporating med ball throws. And this question jumped out to me just because a few years ago I had the opportunity to work with a whole golf team from a junior college here in Southern California, and helped them put about 9 yards on average on their drive, and did this through a lot of med ball throwing. And sort of the way that I approached their training was training them like very weak hammer throwers. And this stemmed from my old college roommate, Nate Rolfe, having not played a lot of golf and not having a good-looking golf swing, or not being a good golfer, but I'd never seen anyone swing a golf club as hard as he did. And he was also the number one hammer thrower in the country coming out of high school. So what he had done a lot he had not swung a golf club a lot, but he had done this loaded rotational movement a lot. And so that sort of always stuck in my mind. So I applied this idea of training them like very weak hammer throwers, that a golf club is much lighter than a hammer, and they just didn't have a deep training background. But we did a ton of rotational med ball throwing. Different kind of scoop throws back over the shoulder, using the med ball on a rope to do like simulate a hammer wind, because that was another thing. Coming into college, I had never thrown the hammer, and that first day of hammer training, we were just doing winds, winding the hammer around the head, both directions, doing things like going from kneeling up to standing, back to kneeling while winding from the knees, one knee, both knees, kind of things, and had an ab oblique soreness I had never even
still to this day
even imagined. So we used a lot of exercises like that. So the med ball throw as a group of movements is interesting about how it can be overloaded and how the periodization strategy with that. So likely you may have a fixed weight that you can use. So there's really two phases that we can look at here is when building capacity and then building power. So first you have to build the capacity to be able to do hard training, and that will likely come with increasing intensity. So the first week you may be doing multiple sets of six, and then the next week multiple sets of eight, the same number of sets of eight, and then the same number of sets of 10 following that. So as you increase your capacity and tolerance for the exercise, but doing it all at a relatively flat intensity. So and that's going to be some about your perceived effort, because the way that we're going to measure output for the med ball throw would be the distance that it would be thrown. If you wanted to get really fancy and get like a radar gun out, you could measure the velocity of the throw, but distance is probably a simple enough marker in most of these cases. So you'd want to be for building the capacity, you'd want to be throwing a consistent distance. You wouldn't need to be trying to throw it farther and farther all the time. That would be reserved for developing power. And then as you go to 100% effort throws and are trying to throw and should be throwing a farther and farther distance, then that would be the same as putting more weight onto the barbell. And as we increase the weight on the bar, you're likely going to need to decrease the total volume. So maybe while you finish the capacity block, let's say at four sets of 10 throws, having increased from four sets of six throws, or start finishing at four sets of 10, increasing from two sets of 10, pretty negligible difference in that. Now we're going to need to decrease the number of throws per set, because each throw is a greater stimulus and greater effort. And you may be tuning out to this thing, well, I'm not training for golf, but this concept is going to hold true for med ball throws and jumping training, really, for a number of different sport applications. So now that you're trying to increase the distance of the throw each time, you might go from, two sets of 10 of that throw and two sets of eight of that throw and two sets of six, two sets of five, then cutting out the number of variations of throws that you're doing to reduce the total volume, focusing on more and more specific throwing variations or variations with a likely higher transfer. So in this case for golf and baseball would have a lot of overlap here. You could have a general throw like an overhead backwards or a scoop throw, underhand forwards throw, that are totally linear in nature. And those would be part of the training earlier along with the rotational variations. But as you get closer and closer to competition, you want to focus on more and more specific work. So you would cut out the more general linear throwing in favor of just the rotational throwing. So at first we're going to increase volume, whether we're increasing number of throws per set or total number of sets of the same number of throws, and then you're going to begin to reduce volume as we increase the intensity measured by like velocity or distance of the throw. As you introduce changes in the weight of the ball, that would be a bit of a different, a bit of a more complex question. But, you know, you could go from using heavier, a golf club is very light, a baseball is very light, even, you know, shot put, hammer, javelin, discus are not extremely heavy implements. You know, you think about the 16-pound shot put being thrown by people who bench press 500 pounds, 16 pounds is so insignificant. So you could get into doing things like throwing heavier mid balls earlier for greater strength and lighter balls as you go for more work on the velocity end of like a force velocity curve. So hopefully that helps you kind of periodize. Again, that's going to be useful in the case of the question asker, C. Willis, for golf, but also if you're working with, you know, track and field throwers, baseball athletes, a lot of different applications there. So the question now goes to Max from @BudStinger, asking, can you elaborate on the role of the deadlift and bench press in weightlifting training?
So looks like, let's clarify the word deadlift first. Assuming deadlift meaning like not like a conventional deadlift or a sumo deadlift, but deadlifts as pulls or, you know, a clean deadlift. Bench press and deadlift are going to be essentially general means of training. The deadlift to the clean pulls or snatch pulls that mimic deadlifts, meaning just to the hip, no, without an explosion, can also be some kind of special exercise for certain individuals that need to develop that. But those exercises are essentially general and supportive in nature. They're not going to be something done in, certainly not super close to competitions, not done for people that already possess enormous levels of general strength. The bench press is a suitable exercise for women. I think more bench pressing can be done by some of the female athletes in weightlifting because their upper bodies are generally going to be weaker than men. And as a form of variation, it's a good exercise to be used outside of like the preparation period for a competition. And especially after competition, it gives some stimulus to the upper body and at the same time eliminates a little bit of the overhead work where they don't need to spend so much time, you know, or take a break, I guess, after a competition. Deadlifting itself and the act of pulling or doing pulls are always going to be included in the training. They're going to be essentially something done year-round for almost every weightlifter. The degree to which they're done is going to change, or the way they're done, the intensities used, and the volumes prescribed for those are going to change the effect that it has on the lifter. So really, really heavy single attempt deadlifts are probably very rarely used in the training of weightlifters simply because the time that the amount of time done or the amount of time it takes to execute the lift is outside the realm of really transferring well to weightlifting from the technique standpoint. More volumes, really high volumes in deadlifts can be sort of negative because obviously, again, you're getting into problems where there's an issue with fatigue management. If you're doing, you know, 10 rep maxes on deadlifts, like, you're going to have a hard time recovering from that and training the lifts properly afterward. But from a general standpoint, yeah, deadlifts are used, clean pulls, snatch pulls to the hip, what we would call a snatch or clean deadlift. Those are used as a technical learning tool at lighter intensities and as a general strength development tool in early parts of training and then even in complexes and whatnot for special preparation, you know, as they get closer to competition. So both exercises are useful. They're used, just a matter of when they're used. Neither one is really going to be used super close to competition. And they're both very good at general strength development and some technical perfection.
All right. So we're going to take another quick break for you to learn about my newest product, the Beginner's Guide to Powerlifting, which I created really with lifters with less than 1 year experience in mind to help them get off to the best start possible and set themselves up for long-term success. So there are detailed exercise tutorials in there for squat, bench, deadlift, and sumo deadlift, as well as a 12-week training program in which every exercise is demonstrated and explained, and as well as explained within the context of the program, kind of why we're doing it, and a very strategically organized exercises through these four different phases in the 12 weeks to help you improve your work capacity, improve your technical skills in the exercises, as well as building confidence, working up towards maxing out and, you know, testing to see where you're at to really begin more structured long-term training. So check that out, The Beginner's Guide to Powerlifting by me. So that was The Beginner's Guide to Powerlifting. Go check that out if you're a beginner, you work with beginners, or you know a beginner who's maybe a little bit intimidated and not sure where to start. So our next question comes on Instagram from Chris Arms. I'm guessing that his last name is just Arms, and this YGK part at the end is a different thing. So Chris Arms, YGK. If you have a lengthy gap between weightlifting competition, about 5 months, would it make more sense to spend an extended period of time working on hypertrophy prior to beginning a meet prep program, or should you structure your training to include like a mock meet at the midway point? And he says that he's asking this specifically for a lifter very early in their career, maybe with some training background, but not specific to weightlifting. So I think we'll talk about this for the principles behind this for powerlifting and weightlifting, as well as how the athlete's level of preparation would affect it. So you want to?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously the first thing you have to ask is what is necessary for the athlete to develop, right? Assuming, because we know they're pretty early on, the technical skills are going to be somewhat lacking, I'm guessing, their technique. They can't take an extended period of time away from practicing the actual sport movements. So that, you know, that period of time is still going to be general because, again, assuming they're younger or they're intermediate, like you said, more general training can occur there. It's kind of up to preference in terms of that lifter as, or the coach lifter, that situation, how general that's going to be. If they're going to do a competition, you know, if they already have six meets planned that year, then they don't need to do a mock meet. If they've done one competition their whole life, then some competition experience will augment their training. But in general, that long gap, the biggest and most important thing for them is to maintain and still develop the technical skills in weightlifting. The training can be general. They can spend more time in those general phases, but I would recommend that there's probably a mock meet or some type of at least halfway between really general training and the peaking for a competition. They need to spend time still developing the skills. They can still do general training because it's necessary. We know at their level of development. And then there's not a big need to have a actual peaking or realization kind of in the middle of that training. They could just attend a competition as a, you know, planned heavy training session without the idea of like actually doing like a meet prep training cycle for that 5 months, then going to another one for the more important competition. But at that level of development, assuming it's intermediate, and my mind wrapping itself around what I think an intermediate lifter would be in this case, they, you're going to have a program that's somewhat similar to what it has been for those 5 months, because they still need to develop all the same things that they were prior to that. It's not like they're going to need to change gears or shift gears dramatically to make up for weaknesses that they maybe didn't develop a long time ago and have, you know, a really wildly different program. They need to still develop general qualities, maintain technique, keep it intact, and then, you know, have a mini competition that really is not something they peak for.
Yeah, I think a couple, three ideas to jump on from there, and hopefully I can remember them all as we talk about them. I think you have a really good way for weightlifting, a simple idea to assess between beginner and intermediate.
Oh, yeah.
Share that.
So how I approach the idea of intermediate or beginner intermediate is a beginner lifter is somebody who maybe will make a mistake in a technique in the lift, snatch, the clean and jerk, differently throughout the time they do it. You become an intermediate lifter when the technique you've practiced is solidified to the point that every time you miss, you make the same error. Obviously, people are going to miss, you know, forward or back or do something here and there that's, you know, a little wonky. But if your technical error starts to show itself and solidify itself as the same consistent error every time, you've moved from being a beginner lifter to an intermediate lifter.
Yeah, that goes kind of right in hand with the four stages of learning from unconscious or unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence to unconscious competence. So basically, very, very beginner, you screwed it up and you had no idea why. Then the sort of change that Max is talking about is you're making the mistake, but maybe you understand why, but there's a wider variety of those mistakes to cutting down, focusing down to sort of making the same mistakes over and over, but not quite sure where to fix it. That's sort of where that transition, really a beginner to intermediate, occurs. So then the other things to consider to sort of balance against each other, this idea of why you'd maybe want to do that mock competition or real competition in the middle of this five-month period is for a beginner athlete and for all athletes, competing is a skill. Yeah. So if it's someone who has not competed specifically in weightlifting or powerlifting very much, doing a meet could be beneficial to them just to develop some comfort, some familiarity with that. Now you have to go in and set them up for success in that. So then it becomes a balance of, do I want to do two and a half month training cycles, peaking twice for it, so that they lift the highest result possible, or, and I think this second is the better option, that you truly just use that as a training time, but they have to accept and embrace the idea that I'm just doing this to practice competing. I'm not trying to make my greatest results ever there, because if you're faced with 5 months of training and the most important time, and again, this is a snapshot of someone's career, but the most important time for them is the end of the 5 months, to produce the best result at the end of the 5 months. By having a 5 month training cycle, you will produce a better result at the end of it than you would at doing two and a half month training cycles. Now, this is the concept of phase potentiation. You're going to develop higher general qualities with a longer general phase, and then you will develop higher specific qualities with a longer specific phase. And it is marginal, how much better the result at the end of 5 months would be compared to the result of two and a half month training cycles, but you'll be a little bit better off with that. So if you can convince the athlete and get them on board with, all right, we're going to treat this real or mock competition in the middle is just, we're just practicing competition. We're getting comfortable with, the timing of warmups in the back room and the commands on the platform for powerlifting, all that kind of stuff, rather than they get there and think, I have to make the highest, I have to make all PRs or whatever. Set them up for success in something beyond just weight lifted. In that, I think, is really important.
Something, my definition for intermediate to advanced lifter, and this coincides there, is that, and the difference between an advanced lifter and intermediate is that no amount, or essentially no amount of detraining, and then a subsequent initiation of training will have an effect on the way in which their technique is executed. So Chad could stop squatting for 2 years, come back and squat, and obviously day 1, 2, and 3 or whatever is not going to be there, but within a very, very short time, he's back to his original squat technique. There's no There's no ability to really modify that, even though he's completely detrained. The reason that is the case is because, or the reason like a 5 month period for an advanced lifter is very different, is that they can be further removed from practicing the sports skill itself while spending more energy and more time in a unilateral way developing the physical qualities, right? So you could have an extended general phase of training for a very highly qualified weightlifter. For example, Ilya Illin taking an entire year of training off, essentially still going to the gym and screwing around, but a year off, and be able to regain his technique at a high level very quickly. A lifter who's super advanced could spend more of their time away from consistent practice of the sports skill in order to develop the physical qualities, so they can then, you know, what Chad just said, increase general qualities and increase specific stuff.
Or to manage the psychological aspects of training to avoid staleness, burnout type of things. And I think that becomes more and more significant as the athlete becomes more and more advanced. You know, if someone's been weightlifting for 6 months and they're already feeling like, oh my, I'm just so burnt out, I need a break, it's probably not for them. They probably want to find a different hobby because they're not really that into it.
Yeah.
You know, if after 15 years of it, they're like, yeah, I could use a couple months of not squat, bench, and deadlift, or of not snatch and clean and jerk every day, kind of thing. That is to be expected. And if you can be preemptive in before they get to that time of feeling like, oh, I'm really sick of this, and rather have them, you know, right before that happens, so right after competition, maybe like, all right, take 2 months, take a month or 2 months preemptively of very general fun type of training. You may be able to protect yourself against them needing 4 months or 6 months of it once they're just like, fuck it, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
kind of thing.
I think it's important that you see a lot of times people ask questions where they're talking about the length of time. Oh, I need more muscle mass or whatever. Should I just spend 6 months in hypertrophy? You know, but the reality is they have no foundation of training, right? So it's that's more, I mean, powerlifting would be a little bit less of an issue because they're going to do squat, bench, and deadlift for hypertrophy still. But in weightlifting, spending an enormous amount of time on general qualities at the expense of learning the technical skills is probably a mistake for beginners and for more intermediate people. So it's less that distinction between advanced, intermediate, and beginner becomes much more important to understand when you have extended periods of time devoted to one quality.
Yeah. And it's that distinction between beginner, intermediate, advanced is going to dictate the proportions of the different phases. So as we look at this, from the question, 5 month period for powerlifting, that beginner athlete, so let's say less than 3 years serious training experience with maybe a class two or lower total. Again, there's more than that goes into defining beginner, and training histories can become a bit more convoluted, you know, particularly as the athlete gets older and older. There's so many different things they could have done leading up to that. But a more beginner athlete is going to want to spend, of that 5 months, probably 2 months of it, maybe 2.5 months of it in hypertrophy training, looking to build more muscle. Where the intermediate athlete might be more like 1 to 2 months, and the advanced athlete would probably be spending probably 1 month, but that would pretty much just be to avoid directed adaptation, to avoid staleness, to give their joints a break. So it might not even be hypertrophy training. It might just be very general training in nature, because an advanced athlete, part of being advanced probably means that they have maximized the amount of muscle or nearly maximized the amount of muscle they have relative to their weight class. So doing hypertrophy training and adding even more muscle and maybe creating a more drastic weight cut becoming necessary wouldn't be a great strategy. So then the intermediate athlete is going to spend a longer time in strength. So of that 5 months, maybe they're spending 2.5 months in general strength training. And then finally, the advanced athlete would have the relative longest peaking phase, maybe, you know, 6 weeks to 2 months of peaking for the advanced athlete, while the intermediate is more like 4 to 6 weeks, and a beginner athlete could be more like 2 to 4 weeks.
Yeah, very much. That's
same kind of phase.
Yes, that's for right. Same thing. Same thing for weightlifting, right? Very, very similar. The structure is going to be almost identical. It's really just the means that are being used. There might be slightly different parameters in terms of the amount of technical work that's executed in any one of those phases, but essentially the same structure.
Yeah, I think the real big distinction there would be that the beginner, because the technique of weightlifting is so much more precise, that even though the beginner athlete is doing a lot of general work, it would have to be a lot of general work around still keeping in the lifts, compared to, you know, someone who's done 10,000 snatches and 10,000 clean jerks in their life,
right?
Who can go, you know, 6 weeks or 8 weeks without snatching and clean and jerking from the floor and not forget how to do it.
Right.
Someone who's been doing it for 6 months, if you've only been doing it for 6 months and you stopped doing it, you know, they count the classic lifts from the floor for 1 month or 2 months, let's say 2 months, you know, you would have spent now a third of your career not doing the lifts.
Yeah.
So, hopefully that gives some good insight in how to kind of structure these different phases. That's another episode of The Jug Life. Thank you for the questions. If you enjoy the podcast, and we would really appreciate this, if you can go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny and or nice, like Kate is great, spelled with some number 8s in there, but I'm pretty sure that that's what it is, as with several R's in the great, like a Tony the Tiger.
Tony the Tiger scenario.
Yes, a Tony the Tiger type scenario. Says that, love it. 5 stars. I haven't really gotten into podcasts before you guys. Love hearing your tips, your advice, and your jokes. Totally hooked. Well, thank you, Kate. I'm really into podcasts. I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
So if besides The Jug Life, if you're interested in the other podcasts that I listen to, 30 for 30 podcasts on ESPN, is really good. Serial was good, but it was Up and Vanished.
Oh man, that was
I got Max in the Up and Vanished too. If you like that true crime stuff, Up and Vanished is really good. The TED Radio Hour has a lot of interesting topics. Undisclosed was one that I was into as well, like another true crime one. It was a bit more in depth on the same subject originally as Serial was.
The True Crime Garage.
Yeah, True Crime Garage has some good ones for sure.
Decent ones.
I think the all the true crime and the lawyer type of ones, my best friend and his wife are both lawyers, so I maybe tend towards those, so I can sound educated when talking to them.
Objection.
But, yeah. Hearsay erroneous.
Habeas corpus.
Yeah, so those are some of the other ones that I like. But Kate, we're glad that you are enjoying it, and thank you for the review. So please send me an email, chad@jtsstrength.com, and we'll get some gear out to you. Beyond that, we're always proud of the work we do on YouTube, thanks to the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. So make sure you subscribe to see all sorts of content for weightlifting, powerlifting, nutrition, and movement, as well as the video episodes of The Jug Life. If you're interested in powerlifting or weightlifting coaching or super total, visit juggernautcoaching.com and see all of our different programs we have available for that. And Max, where can they find you?
You find me on Instagram, max_ada, Facebook, or email me at max@jtsstrength.com.
And I am Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith and @JuggernautTraining on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. This was The Jug Life. Thanks for watching or listening. Again, you can find us on iTunes, YouTube, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and thejuglife.com. And we'll see you next week.